Good evening. My name is Thomas Steininger. I welcome you to Redevolve, our global webcast for consciousness and culture. I'm very happy to have with me here in the broadcast, Roger Welsh. Roger, great you're here.
It's a delight. Thank you so much for the invitation. I'm very happy to be with you and be with your audience.
Just for the people who might not know you, some words to introduce you. You're a professor of psychiatry, philosophy, and anthropology at the University of California in Irvine, in California. You're author of many books. One of the last ones, I think, is The World, Great Wisdom, What Sages Say About Living Wisely and Well. And you're a well-known author and speaker in the field of transpersonal psychology and integral thinking. And in fact, I would like to start our conversation with, on one hand, a very simple, but on the other hand, a very demanding question. But I really would like to put your mind and all your psychological, spiritual background to ask you, from your life experience, what is important to live a good life in the days that we are living in right now?
Oh, what a wonderful question. And I suspect for both of us and for practically all our listeners, this is one of the key questions that guide our life. If we look at it from various perspectives, it's what's called a sacred question. That is a question which, if we go into it deeply, it becomes a center and focus of our lives, and the answers we give and the depth with which we explore it really become the guidelines for the direction and depth of our lives. From another perspective, it's what in Zen would be called a Genji koan, it's a koan which arises out of life itself. And so, of course, there are many ways into this. What is important for a good life in our times? Let's start with intention, because a good general principle before beginning anything is to ask, what is this for? Mm-hmm. And the answer really determines the direction and ways in which we proceed. So why do we seek for a good life, and what is it? I'll speak from my own experience. I mean, looking at this, the more deeply I look, the bedrock I come to is, the goal is to reduce suffering and enhance well-being for as many as possible. Now, how we unpack that will depend on our own particular perspective and the amount of reflection we've given. For me, it becomes, how can we best serve the welfare and awakening of all? And at a deeper level, it points us towards the Bodhisattva aspiration, which is, as far as I can see, the highest ideal that the human mind has ever conceived, the idea of offering one's life as an instrument of service, with the recognition that the deepest roots of our suffering really are a reflection of our unconsciousness, our immersion in delusion or ignorance or whatever phrase you want to give it, and that the optimum contribution involves not only working to deal with the outer situations and problems such as starvation and malnutrition and global and social unrest, etc., but also simultaneously to deal with the underlying root causes. And one of the deepest causes at the individual level, but also the collective, is our individual and collective unconsciousness. And for that, as I said, it seems like the Bodhisattva aspiration is perhaps one of the most profound perspectives on that. The offering of one's life for the welfare and awakening of all, by awakening and actualizing one's own capacities as fully as possible in order to be an optimal instrument of service.
The reason why I started with this question is because, of course, in order to answer this question, we really also have to ask who we are, because only from there really the answer makes any sense. And I see you as one of the representatives of a new spiritual awakening in the West in the last 30 years, where independent, or at least to a degree independent of the traditions of the great world traditions, there was a new understanding or a new search for the depth of life, where our understanding of who we are as humans is not just a kind of our utilitarian, pragmatic, materialist understanding, but there's something that we do call spiritual. And you can say that there was a big spiritual movement in the last 30 years that is new. We are not really in the same way living in a secular age anymore as we used to be. There is more interest, or let's say more fresh interest in something like spiritual questions, more new interest. At the same time, I find also that this spiritual movement that had different waves, there was the New Age spirituality, there was transpersonal psychology, there's integral spirituality, that quite often it was very much related also to our own psychological well-being. And there's a big connection between the spiritual surge that we experienced in this last decades and our psychological understanding. But my question is that maybe this psychological context that we are searching in is also a limiting context, because we start to do therapy, we start to meditate, go for spiritual wisdom, but the context is something like a psychological well-being.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe we are at a point, I mean, there's a lot to it. I don't want to say that this is a wrong thing to do, but maybe there is a limitation that we are more aware of right now than 30 years ago, and that a good life also has to kind of cross a border here and go beyond this psychological context of the spiritual search. Is this something that you, who also as from your own career comes very much from this psychological foundation, would agree with?
Yes, I think you're pointing to something very important, that the perspective we bring to the search for a good life, to spiritual practice, both serves and limits, and any particular perspective has its in traditional Huayin Buddhism, they say that every perspective both reveals and conceals. Mm-hmm. And so the psychological perspective, which has been available to us over the last, say, 40, 50 years now, which has begun to acknowledge, not necessarily so much in the mainstream, but at least in fields like transpersonal psychology, integral psychology, begun to recognize things like states of consciousness and post-conventional development. Those have been doorways which have both legitimized and explained and encouraged both a psychological and spiritual growth. And at the same time, the deeper levels of spirituality involve a moving beyond concepts, a so-called transconceptual experience, direct experience, intuition, and also the psychological maps we have just aren't yet as adequate to the full array of spiritual experiences. So I think you're pointing to something very important, and also the psychological maps have not, until quite recently, appreciated the importance of, for example, contribution and service. Now we're beginning to see the appearance of a literature on contribution, service, and the benefits for both the giver and the receiver, the idea of a helper's high and so forth. But still, do not approach the depth of some of the spiritual traditions themselves. And of course, the spiritual traditions, historical traditions themselves have their own limits. They're couched in often archaic language and concepts, and they need updating. And another advantage of these psychological maps is that they've begun to translate venerable, valuable ideas into a contemporary conceptual framework and language and concept system so as to make them more comprehensible for our time.
I mean, we as a culture, on one hand, we have something like a spiritual opening that also reaches the mainstream. If you talk about mindfulness, mindfulness was something that just 5 years ago was a fringe appearance somewhere, and if I'm not wrong, it at least was twice on a Times cover. It was definitely on a Spiegel cover in Germany. So Google is talking about mindfulness. So that there's something where something that in its particular roots has a direct Buddhist meditation background. It's just kind of reframed also in the medical, psychological understanding of what meditation is about and understood as mindfulness. There is something where we are aware as a culture that we have to go to attentive way of relating to reality. Let's put it that way. And where our usual pragmatic instrumental relationship to everything is not creating a good life, not for, yeah, for oneself, and not for the other, and not for the globe as a whole. At the same time, this mindfulness, would you say that there is a cultural paradigm shift in the midst in that is really promising, that allows us to see the dawn of a new human culture? Or is it some nice gimmick that we can basically meditate to be more productive? Do you see that there's something really, a beginning possibility of a profound a cultural shift in a positive way, or is it just contextualized by our usual understanding of productivity and kind of our everyday understanding of life? Where are we as a culture in this?
Well, there's an awful lot in what you said, so let me see what I can reflect on that. First off, let's acknowledge that there are so many in the culture at large. There are so many movements and ideas and dynamics and forces operating that it's very hard to say culture is moving in one particular way. Mm-hmm. So it's obviously all of us know that, but it's worth emphasizing that it's just so complex. And within it, we can see certain movements and openings and streams and forces. Speak first to your question of the larger picture of a cultural shift, and one way that is very valuable looking at this. One thing that has clearly been happening over the last 50 years since the advent of psychedelics and then the introduction of Asian contemplative practices, and then after that the reviving of Western contemplative practices, is that our culture is going, what is moving from what anthropologists call a monophasic culture to a polyphasic culture. We are moving from a monophasic culture, a culture in which we emphasize and draw our understanding of the world and ourselves from only one state of consciousness, the usual waking state, and we are shifting towards a polyphasic culture, a culture which makes use of and values and draws its understanding from multiple states, from dreams, from reverie, from hypnosis, from meditation, from contemplation, etc. So that's a really important shift, which is not recognized almost at all So something very important there is happening. I think we could all agree that we can see that beginning. You know, we now have an understanding of altered states, both as a some understanding anyway, as a culture, and now in even in mainstream psychology. So that's one big context. And if we look at particular practices such as mindfulness, we find again a two-edged process. We find the introduction of these very powerful, transformative, healing, maturing, clarifying, awakening practices, and we find them assimilated into the conventional worldview and used for conventional values. Mm-hmm. And there's a very important concept that comes out of Piaget, the great Swiss developmental psychologist. He drew a distinction between what can happen when we have a new experience. He said we can either assimilate it into our current understanding and worldview, and that's kind of a stagnation, or we can accommodate, that is, we can allow our belief system, our worldview to expand to include this new experience within a deeper and broader and a larger framework. So if we look at that from a cultural perspective, we could say that a practice such as mindfulness is largely assimilated within the conventional worldview and its value system, such as, yeah, this will make us more productive, it'll increase the bottom line, it'll reduce our stress and anxiety and enable us to work harder. And the beauty of these practices is people get more from them than they expect because they are inherently transformative. So someone may, I and I'm sure you know a lot of people who went in to reduce, for example, their blood pressure and found their life changed. So I look at it as kind of a Trojan horse that is sneaking into our culture, in some ways just being assimilated into the conventional worldview, but is also having a larger and more profound effects than a lot of people bargained for.
First of all, I appreciate that you brought this warning also in that one shouldn't too fast talk about the one development of culture where we're going, because there are many things going on at the same time. It's maybe safer to talk about that there are cultural openings that are happening, right, that have a potential for the multiplicity of the culture that we're living in. And we're living in a multiplicity of culture in our Western world, and also our world is bigger than our Western world, and our global world is rapidly becoming one world in many ways, being connected and interacting with each other in all these different levels. So there's a lot going on at the same time. At the same time, there is a kind of a dominant culture that is of European American origin, that comes from a particular cosmology that was born in the 15th century in European Enlightenment. It has a lot to do with individuation, with rationality, with a subject-object understanding of the world that created a lot of beautiful and powerful things, which we call modernity, democracy. Everything is based on that. At the same time, it seems that modern democratic, also capitalism, with all what it brought to the world, and I mean a good thing, because we really developed a lot of wealth in this, but there seems to be a lot of questions how this particular cosmology and understanding of who we are as human maybe creates more and more difficulties for us to live as a global civilization. My question first, would you agree with that? And second, would you think that this kind of new spirituality that we kind of touched on, mindfulness being one of them, has answers for this and has something where it's worth looking deeper into to kind of transform, develop our understanding of who we are as humans and also who we are as a human culture?
Yeah, beautiful questions. I love the way you you frame these big these big questions and challenges. So you gave us a picture of basically cultural evolution over the last few centuries and some of the challenges we're facing from that. And I think I would agree very much and put what you've said in kind of a cultural evolution framework. We could think of, for example, Hegel with his idea that every stage has its inbuilt, every cultural stage has built into it its own limitations. Mm-hmm. And that sooner or later we will run into those and they will evoke a reaction and hopefully call forth a synthesis. So we could look at what's happening in a kind of Hegelian dialectical terms as, yes, with the Renaissance, with the birth of science, with this worldview that science has basically come to provide us, largely material, a largely reductionistic perspective that served us in many ways, as you said, gave us many gifts, and we are clearly facing the limitations of that worldview and that perspective. And clearly that kind of scientifically dominated understanding of the world and life is very useful for technology, and it's not clearly not adequate for a fully satisfying human life. The idea that we are just the products of the random clashing of atoms without any meaning or larger purpose, etc., does not fit with the experience we have, particularly the more deeply we go into our experience. So I would agree with that. And the second question you then raised is, do these new forms of spirituality and these new practices, or some of these ancient practices brought to our culture and times, do they have some answers? And I think clearly they do. They don't. No one thing has the entire answer, and I think that's very important for us to recognize, because it's easy to, and we see some people assuming that, for example, if we just do spiritual practice, that will answer all our problems. And I used to believe that myself, and it clearly isn't so. Another thing that's really important we probably should emphasize here, it's not just practices, but it's also how skillfully they are used and for what purpose. And you touched on this earlier. So do these new practices have something to add? Absolutely. Do the worldviews and cultures and wisdom traditions out of which they come have a complementary and enlarging perspective to offer us, one which complements, enlarges, out-contextualizes, integrates the dominant scientific materialistic worldview? Absolutely. And one of the tasks of our time, which no time has ever, no culture has ever had before, is the updating of our spiritual traditions to include contemporary knowledge and science. And throughout history, we have a double challenge. Throughout history, whenever a tradition comes into a new culture, there's a period of translation and assimilation. And Carl Jung introduced a wonderful idea of a Gnostic intermediary. He described a Gnostic intermediary as someone who is able to translate a wisdom tradition to a new culture. And he said that requires three things. First, you have to imbibe the wisdom yourself. You can't just know it theoretically. You have to really imbibe it and become it. Then you have to learn the language and conceptual system, the culture you want to translate to. And then you have to translate so as to create an aha experience of, oh, yes, that makes sense. But so with the introduction, for example, of Buddhist or yogic or Confucian or Taoist or Islamic practices to the West, we many of us are trying to work as Gnostic intermediaries to explain and legitimate and make these comprehensible. But we're also called to do something else. This is the first time we are called to translate these cultures and traditions and practices from an agrarian worldview to a postmodern or metamodern worldview and make sense of them, not only across cultures, but across eras. So this is we're kind of we're all, anyone who's deeply involved in practice and in responding to the great issues of our time is really a Gnostic intermediary, whether they know it or not. And so that's one of the callings of our time. So those are a few reflections to you, those great questions of yours.
The reason why I asked this question, and you really touched on this in your response in different ways, is because I'm looking forward, what does this new spirituality really contribute in order to the answers that we need personally, but also as a culture in the time that we're living? And if I may just say some kind of thoughts from my side, and I was just curious what do you think? Because when you look about this different spiritual practice, from shamanistic spiritual practice, from Eastern spiritual practices, Sufi practices, also kind of esoteric Christianity, there's a whole variety, and you can't kind of put them just into one box. It's a whole. I don't think that it's fair to just kind of think that they are the same thing in different disguise. But at the same time, there is something that I find connecting, and that I also see in the mindfulness movement, if I may say so, that is a response to our usual way we are in the world, where we are very much, because of our let's call it European American identity, very aware of our individual separate existence and our pragmatic, rational way of being able to relate to the world, mostly as kind of material facts, where we can create wealth of all of that. So there's a certain form we are in the world, where we see us very much as individuated separate selves, and we can act with reality objects. But all these practices, I think, show us two things. One, in different ways, a form of non-separation, that maybe, yes, we are highly individuated people, and I think this is also important to acknowledge that this is really an achievement of Western Enlightenment, to really honor our individual adult identity as something, as someone who can take responsibility. It's a powerful thing. But that our sense of separation maybe also needs being softened by reality, that there is a non-separation when we just pay attention, that is much more real than we usually are aware of. And the other thing, and also these traditions do this in very different ways, but they do it. It's an awareness of, if I just may use the word, the sacred. Whatever that is, there's different understanding. There's a different understanding of shamanistic understanding of sacred, or Catholic understanding of sacred. But there's something where I allow whatever the word means, but there's a resonance with this word, something is sacred, that is beyond pragmatic. And I feel that this is for us, in the way we live our lives and how we live our culture, something important to look into, that maybe we have something to learn about our non-separation and about the reality of the sacred. And that this is something where maybe also the learning points of us personally and as a culture are, and where there's a lot to learn from, also transpersonal psychology, integral theory, all these new attempts to kind of go beyond just the usual way of understanding who we are as humans.
Beautiful. Yes, yes, yes. I'd love to just have some responses to that. The big question you had was, what are the contributions of these different spiritual traditions, and how do they speak to the issues of our time? That was the kind of context of your question. And then you raised questions about how do they have a contribution to make to our understanding of life and the world and to the way we value it? And what do the practices themselves do in that way? And then there's something you alluded to, but perhaps we want to draw out, and that is how do we use them to creatively respond to the issues of our time? Clearly, as you said, there are significant differences across traditions, and the old idea of just, the transcendental unity of traditions, religions, that kind of perennialism, I think, no longer holds. But there, as you say, there are common themes, and there are common understandings, and they do have offer a complementary, enriching understanding to our materialist dominant worldview. And they include, as you said, very different, very valuable complementary understandings of, for example, human nature. That the more, and I think the beauty of some of these practices is that they, unlike traditional, conventional level religion, conventional religion centers on a narrative or on a story. Mm-hmm. And if you believe the narrative, you're saved. If you don't, you're in trouble. But post-conventional, or better, trans-conventional religion practices center on a mind, a training of heart and mind to cultivate qualities and capacities and virtues. And these are very, very different understandings of the nature of religion. And unfortunately, our culture usually only understands the first, the conventional understanding of religion as faith-based. So this is these spiritual traditions and practices bring a very different understanding, first of religion, and then second of our human nature. But the beauty of these practices is we don't have to take their assumptions on faith. We can test them all for ourselves in our own practice, within our own within our own minds, and see to what extent they hold true for us. And what I think anyone who does deep practice in an experimental way finds is that we are not only more than we thought, more than we can think, and that our deeper nature is way more than can be embraced by any materialist, reductionistic perspective. And that's something we just discover in our own ways. Then, of course, both the traditions themselves and what we discover as we practice offer us very different understandings of things like motivation. It becomes very clear that, for example, just getting more things is nice, but it's not never fully or completely satisfying. It gives us a very different understanding of, for example, ethics. At a conventional level, in our culture, we think of ethics as a kind of self-sacrifice. But the more deeply we practice, the more we discover that ethical living is actually a win-win situation. Our lives work better, we feel better when we're ethical. So ethics becomes enlightened self-interest. And at a still deeper level, a deep contemplative level, as we explore ethics, we find that, for example, any time we're tempted to be unethical, to hurt or to harm people, including ourselves, if we look in at that time, we find our mind dominated by motives such as greed or jealousy, and dominated by painful, destructive emotions like fear, anger, hatred, etc. And so we move to a still deeper understanding of ethics, from which we are spontaneously moved to treat everyone, ourselves included, in the most benevolent ways possible. So these are very different understandings of human nature, of motivation, of ethics, of purpose. which are transmitted from the traditions, but which we also come to see for ourselves. So these are, as you said, very important complements to our contemporary scientific world, conventional worldview. And of course, the challenge of our time is to integrate these, not to deny, as you said, the value of science, but to integrate them into a larger perspective. And then, as a result of this, to recognize, as we do, as we practice deeply, that we don't practice for ourselves alone. We practice for a larger purpose, which includes the welfare and well-being of others. So that leads to the question of then, from this deeper, newer understanding I have, what's the most strategic contribution I can make? And then looking, that becomes a practice in itself. It traditionally was called karma yoga, but of course now we think of it as sacred service or any other number of terms. So all this is actually just an amplification on what you were saying and an agreement with what you were saying, and an honoring of the value of these new practices and the availability of these traditions at this time, and the wonderful opportunity we have of both doing the practices and creating some larger understanding which acknowledges uses the science and knowledge of our time in the larger context that these practices and traditions offer us.
No, I very much agree, and I would like to emphasize what you said about the necessity of integration and the larger context. Because I started this conversation with this very simple, but of course, kind of also tricky question, what does it mean to live a good life? Because, of course, in one way, this is the question in the end of yes. A human life. And everything is included in this one question. What does it mean to live a good life? And we touched on several points, and I consciously tried to really open up the picture to big contexts where the depth of spirituality, the depth of the wisdom tradition, but also the depth of the world and world history has part in that. And when I hear you emphasizing the importance of integration in the big picture, it's also something that we just have to admit it, which is demanding. Yes. Because to integrate means also that you have to be aware of. So it's also something that you can't just do on a cushion or in a praying position. You have to be aware of many dimensions of reality, which is also history, psychology, a lot of things. And I don't mean that every single one of us has to be aware of everything, because that's kind of a daunting thing to do.
Yeah.
But we can be together in something and create an understanding where different people of us hold different parts of it, so that we can bring together it as a living cultural whole. But maybe an integral culture means that, so that the beauty also of our Western modernist rational society can flower when its limitation can be seen in the light of the traditions, as we see the limitations of the traditions in light of Western science. But this means something that at least there have to be people who engage with really trying to be there for the complexity of life that we are confronted with, and allow ourselves to find new forms of integration, and also to see that maybe our mental way how to do that won't be able to do this.
Yes.
What I mean is, and that's partly also, if you may say so, kind of a question mark on some forms of application of integral theory, the idea that you can put everything into a map and then you just have to practice it, that maybe you are asking too much of the mind, that you're more talking about how to do this in how we live together, how we hold, and some people have to dive into intellectually all of that, but basically an integral culture means maybe a dialogical culture where all these different parts can speak to each other, where traditions with what they have to contribute speak to us as modern, scientifically educated humans, that we allow them to speak to us and see what speaks again. And at the same time, see that there are different cultures, if I may bring this also in, it's another level, different cultures out there that are not just European American. There are 1,000 years old Indian culture, Chinese culture, African culture, to allow that even these cultures speak to each other in order to find a way that some form of wholeness is forming as we talk. And this maybe sounds a little kind of vague, but in the other way, I think in this dialogical form of holding this together and allow it to be seen in non-separation is something that is a way where the different qualities of wisdom, science, different cultures are naturally kind of informing each other. And maybe that's much more what an integral culture can be about than having a map about everything.
Well, Thomas, I have a very simple answer to that. Yes. beautifully said. I would agree completely. And clearly, this is one of the great gifts and opportunities and simultaneously one of the great challenges of our time, that we have the meeting of cultures, we have the meeting and mixing of religious traditions, we have we have new disciplines and new knowledge at accumulating at exponential rates. And the question, one of the great questions of life for us at this stage is how do we stay open to this richness and complexity and overwhelming demands in a way which is healthy, contributory, and not overwhelming. And I think you made an important point you made many important points. One of them was that none of us can do it alone. In fact, it's not clear that all of us can do it. In fact, one of the great challenges of our time is the sheer complexity of the world and civilization we've built and whether we have the wherewithal to manage this complexity. And yet you pointed to the necessity of staying open to and to recognizing that an appropriate opening to this extraordinary richness involves many modalities, not just the intellectual and conceptual, but the intuitive, the contemplative, the symbolic, the artistic, the aesthetic, etc. So, and all of us are specialized. You know, I'm somewhat cerebral. I have very little artistic capacity. So for me, that it's mainly an intellectual opening. But we are called to an openness, and one of the beauties we discover as we do contemplative practice is that it is possible to be in a way in which we are simply open and allowing the world into us, and that allowing that separation between ourselves and others to dissolve, and even the separation between ourselves and the world to dissolve, and coming to trust in our own minds' capacities for assimilating and integrating, not through a conscious putting, you know, an intellectual fitting of ideas together consciously, but rather by an intuitive apprehension which allows a holistic transconceptual knowing or appreciation to emerge. And of course, it's still very limited for all of us. Gee, there's so much in what you said, but I could say some more, but is there somewhere else specifically you'd like to go with this?
No, I'm very happy what you said about the openness, because and the openness and the non-separation, because that may be my own version of oversimplification, but I say it anyway. What I find most valuable in these contemplative practices and the reemergence of the wisdom traditions is exactly this acknowledgement of non-separation as it is right now, whatever this means. I don't have to grasp it intellectually, just acknowledging in a conversation like this, on a deep heart level, non-separation allows me to be different here with the other, with you in this, and honoring the non-separation. Mm. And there is a guiding principle that is beyond my rational mental capacities that comes in here that also holds, that's the second part that I mentioned before, that there's something sacred in being together in this way.
Yes.
And this may be oversimplified, but this, I see some guiding principle in acknowledging this, and I see this in the way shamanistic culture relates to nature. I see this how Indian culture relates to the transcendence, and you can bring this in all the different variations, and only they have their limitations and shadow sides, all that. I don't want to neglect it, but there's something where not just in a conversation like this, but also in a conversation like this, but also we as a society can be guided by an acknowledgement of that non-separation is something that is accessible when we just allow to be open to that. And then the rest is a finding out, like this conversation is a finding out. And maybe this finding out never has an end, and it's maybe even the beauty of this.
Yes.
But there is something where I find that the New Age spirituality, all of transpersonal psychology brought to it, all our being able to break out of the cocoon and be there and find also trainings to break out, to allow to each other in all this insecurity and also kind of the tension, because, of course, as always, things don't fit necessarily together, and there's greater friction, but to have the soul strength to be together in this, I find is one of the big contribution of this new form of searching wisdom, also in the cultural context that we're in right now. What we're seeing in American European societies falling apart, to bring this in order for human creativity to flower. So that's a very concrete and, I admit, oversimplified way to look at it, where I think that this spiritual search has a real contribution that's much more than just me feeling more happy, but it's something that's needed in our society to heal.
Yes, and again, I would agree completely. And there are several things in there I'd love that you just quickly mentioned, which I'd love to draw out. You said, for example, this exploration is never ending. And yes, indeed. And one of the things that clearly is that comes with spiritual practice and is essential at this time when we're moving into so many unknown new areas is an openness to mystery, the recognition that at bottom, life, experience, everything is at fundamental. When we really look deeply, it's mysterious. And my wife used to say, you know, one of our challenges is to befriend the mystery, because usually we're very defended against recognizing mystery. It brings up insecurity, not knowing, and yet there's this recognition across traditions and cultures that the mystery is really crucial. For example, in the Eastern temples, the twin lions which guard the gates of the temples are sometimes said to represent confusion and paradox. And the person who would have wisdom must move through that not knowing. And if we look at the recent research on developmental psychology and the some of the capacities that come online at higher developmental stages, the so-called post-conventional stages, we find that one of the capacities is an openness to mystery, that people recognize the limits of the intellect and become comfortable with that and open to, and if we're open to the mystery, then we can be comfortable with the extraordinary richness and complexity, incomprehensible as it may be, but it allows us to open to that, and that opening allows us to be with it and respond to it more creatively and effectively. So, and the two other things you alluded to briefly, one is that in this time we are called to respond creatively. We've never faced these kind of social or global issues before. We've never had such society and issues on such scales. We've never had so many people or such knowledge. So we're really called not just to contribute and to serve and to respond, but to respond creatively, both to our own lives, to be the creative artists of our own lives, and to be creative responders to the great issues and challenges. And that you implied there is a call to service, that as we open to the world and its many needs, the pull of suffering and pain and challenge becomes a kind of sacred calling, sacred service, as you said at the very beginning of our conversation.
Now, again, thank you very much. Also particularly bringing the mystery in, because I think if you would not have brought it in, it would have been missing in this conversation, because maybe it's even the core piece or where everything else can take place in our kind of acknowledging the mystery and the beauty of the mystery. And it sounds kind of a little kitschy if I bring it like that, but in fact it is not. It is an existential question. And to allow this is something that has a lot to do with in our pre-conversation, we said that we would like to talk about maturity. We more talked about the good life, but this maturity is also the capacity to allow the mystery to be part or even the foundation of our being together as humans and as a human society. I really want to bring it up in that way, without taking away of everything that modern life and modern science has to bring, and the curiosity and the creative response that you bring in. But there's something where we have to connect with the fact that the mystery is an important, maybe the important ingredients that allows us in the end to be mature human beings. As kind of strange that may sound, but I deeply think so. And to do this in a way that is acknowledging modernity, the pluralistic capacities of postmodern consciousness, to do this allows us also to have a contribution how we can live a world culture that is a world culture where we can meet and where there's not just a clash of civilizations, as it seems to be now to kind of happen on us. And where I think this is needed, also response, because it is needed for us to find creative solutions where we go as a culture and as a humanity. So we are also in the end of our time. I know we only touched some points, but I am very grateful for what you brought in and the wisdom also of your life, the different areas of your expertise, and that we really could draw out how these are important ingredients for us in our search how to live a good life and how to live a mature life in the context of the time that we are living in.
Well, thank you so much, Thomas. It's just a delight to have a conversation like this and to explore together, which it really feels like. It's been a wonderful exploration together, and also for the opportunity, of course, of sharing it with your listeners. So thank you so much. I'm so grateful and very grateful for the work you're doing in so many ways. So thanks so much.
Thank you so much, and good evening here from Frankfurt in Germany.